Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday was Supreme Court Justice David Souter's last day serving on the nation's highest court. The George H.W. Bush appointee voted in the minority in a case that overturned a decision by his likely replacement, Judge Sonia Sotomayor. Joining me to talk about that case and other major rulings from the Supreme Court, Joan Biskupic of USA Today, George Washington University Law Professor Jeffrey Rosen, and the LA Times' David Savage. We do invite your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Joan Biskupic, what did the court find in this highly anticipated case involving the New Haven, Connecticut firefighters?
Well, as a threshold matter, Diane, the Supreme Court said that the city of New Haven was wrong to throw out the test results of a firefighter promotion test because the whites outscored the blacks and Hispanics.
Give us a little background.
Sure. This was part of a 2003 set of tests, both oral and written, that the Civil Service Board was doing in New Haven to see who would qualify for lieutenant and captain promotions. And when the test results came in, it appeared that whites had disproportionately outscored blacks and Hispanics. The city began to wonder if its results were flawed and also worried about lawsuits from black firefighters who would have been denied promotions. So it threw out the results. White firefighters who had put a lot of time into studying for this test and who felt that they were then on the downside of a race-based decision sued under a law called Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And what's key about the law and what brought the tension to the Supreme Court is that it has two prongs. It says that you cannot discriminate against anyone based on race, discriminatory treatment. But it also has a provision that says that you cannot employ any kind of test or practice that has a discriminatory impact. So the whites said it was discriminatory treatment. The blacks could have alleged there was discriminatory impact if the promotions had gone forward. You referred to Judge Sotomayor's lower court ruling. She was on a panel that, in a terse way, endorsed what New Haven did, and it was unsigned. She was joined by two other judges, so we don't know if she actually wrote it. But it essentially just endorsed what New Haven did without going into the dilemma here of these, as Justice Ginsburg called them, the twin pillars of Title VII. What the Supreme Court said yesterday was that the city did not have enough evidence to show that it was vulnerable to any kind of lawsuit from the blacks who would have been denied promotions, and that it couldn't go simply on these lopsided statistics from the test results. Bottom line of that ruling is it will make employers think twice about just throwing out results from seemingly neutral tests that end up disproportionately hurting minorities in some cases or potentially women in other cases.
Joan Biskupic of USA Today. She also has a new book coming out this fall, a biography of Antonin Scalia. Jeffrey Rosen, what does the Ricci decision mean to all of us?
It means that employers may be more reluctant to use written tests at all and more likely to use holistic assessment centers. Both Justice Kennedy in the majority and Justice Ginsburg in dissent said instead maybe these tests don't predict success for firefighters. Perhaps better to have oral exams on which minorities do better. Now, how dramatic this impact will be, we don't know. After the Supreme Court questioned affirmative action in higher education in 2003, lots of people said universities are going to throw out the SATs and encourage people to write essays about how they overcame disadvantage. Those dire predictions haven't really materialized. In fact, affirmative action has continued. It may be the case that not a lot of cities do what New Haven was foolish enough to do, which is have a test and then openly throw it out. So although some people are predicting dire consequences across the land, it might be more atmospheric. That basically the one thing we know is that four justices on the court are inclined to take a much more radical step and say, let's not have any of this disparate treatment, disparate impact inquiry at all, and throw out Title VII, which Congress passed in the 1990s, and say that you can't look at the effect of these tests on employment. But Justice Kennedy doesn't want to go that far. And as long as he is in the driver's seat, the court is going to stop short of questioning affirmative action at its core.
Jeffrey Rosen, he's professor of law at the George Washington University. He's legal affairs editor of The New Republic, and he's the author of a book titled The Supreme Court. Turning to you now, David Savage, those two words, disparate impact, are key to beginning to understand this whole judgment, which really is important throughout the land.
Particularly in a lot of big cities, fire departments, police departments, this has been fought out for 20 or 30 years. There have been dozens of cases. Some of them, Sonia Sotomayor was involved in one in the early 1980s. The Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund brought a case against the New York City Police Department because there were relatively few black and Hispanic officers. It's been a long-running fight. Those departments all use tests and some sort of regular, they're required by civil service rules. The disparate impact rule that the Supreme Court adopted in the 1970s was one that said, look at the effect, look at the racial effect of your job standards. And that has been the rule for 20 or 30 years. The reason this decision, I think, is important is the Supreme Court is sort of pulling back from that sort of 1970s approach. Five of the justices are very much inclined to say, we shouldn't be looking at the racial effect. We ought to treat people equally, give them a fair test, but the racial effect should not be a big part of the law. And so that's really where the five of them are sort of they want to do that in higher education in a whole lot of areas. They want to say the racial effect shouldn't matter, just treat everybody fairly and equally.
And what is Justice Ruth Ginsburg arguing?
Part of it, her argument is history. She said the majority is sort of ignoring the history of this. Until the early 1970s, she said, and quite correctly, blacks were excluded from a lot of fire departments, including New Haven. There was a suit in New Haven. So she said, if you look at the longer history, it was reasonable for a city like New Haven, half of its population is minorities, to try to bring more blacks and Hispanics into the fire department. And so she said the city should be able to do this to bring about more diversity in their ranks.
David Savage, he's a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. So what are we left with, and how do we go forward with this? Will cities, will fire departments, police departments stick to what they've been doing, or will they now have a brand new set of rules enforced?
Well, when I talked to employment lawyers yesterday, they were mostly saying at this point that they would be more cautious, that they would be advising public employers, especially because, again, as David and Jeff said, that mostly it's public employers
right.
using these kinds of tests, although plenty of corporations, private corporations do too, advising them to be more cautious about reversing course, scrapping the results, changing things midstream when there are certain expectations. In this case, the white firefighters had, in a very public way, had certain expectations that those results were going to be used. Do much more research at the beginning. Make sure you believe that these tests are valid. I think both sides in this case felt that New Haven had not itself really done any favors for the city officials in the way that this had unfolded because of how public it became and how they switched gears on their own thoughts on how valid these were. So I think down the road, there will be a hesitancy to frankly, maybe use these tests and then also to be so sensitive to throwing them out if they start to get complaints. They'll want more evidence. The test that Justice Kennedy used requires a strong basis in evidence that you will be sued, that you will have trouble. So I think it could have an effect on the ground, but we just don't know yet this early.
Jeffrey Rosen, what does the ruling mean for Judge Sotomayor?
Perhaps not so much. She can plausibly argue the Supreme Court changed the law. Before this decision, there was no requirement of a strong basis in evidence. Maybe just a good reason to believe that you were going to be sued, as Justice Ginsburg suggested, would be enough for a city to scrap the test. The one thing this decision shows is that the area is incredibly contested. There's a lot of disagreement among the justices. Conservative critics of Sotomayor are trying to say Justice Ginsburg rejected her position. She would have sent the decision back to the lower court to figure out whether there was a good reason, whereas Sotomayor would have found for the city without even sending it back to the lower court. But I think that's overparsing the difference between the two and also the difference between an appellate judge and a Supreme Court justice. It does remain the case, though, that race is the one question that critics are going to press in the Sotomayor hearings. And to the degree that this just opens up all the cauldron of the uncertainty and disagreement about that, it's going to be front and center.
And one last question on this. Justice Kennedy certainly remains key to this court, David Savage.
Yes, that's the one thing those of us who cover the court know. Every term we can write a story that says this really depends on how Justice Kennedy comes out, because in almost all the big cases, you can find a few minor examples, there's essentially four on the liberal side, four on the conservative side, and Kennedy is the one that tilts it left or right. He's been consistently on the right in the race cases. That is, he thinks affirmative action and race, that the government should be very hesitant to use race. So he's with the conservatives on that. And so that's why you had this 5-4 majority.
David Savage, he's a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about some other very closely decided case and some not so closely. Stay with us. There are so many interesting cases we can talk about this morning. The next I want to go to is the case involving a 13-year-old female high school student. Jeffrey Rosen, the 8-1 decision said that Arizona officials lacked justification for such an invasive search of a 13-year-old girl. Tell us about that case.
Well, how interesting to get an 8-1 majority in a Fourth Amendment strip search case. Often the conservatives are not with the liberals. But here, the court began with an old ruling that says in schools, if you have reasonable suspicion that there's cigarettes in a young girl's purse, you can open it. Here, there was some suspicion that a girl had prescription drugs because one of her friends had said she did and basically ratted her out. So the school officials, based on this tip, began the search of the girl. They searched her backpack. They didn't find anything. But then they went further. They had the school nurse search her invasively, look in her underwear, make her lift her bra in this very humiliating, terrible way that really traumatized her. And the Supreme Court said that second step went too far after the school officials satisfied themselves that there was not prescription drugs in the backpack and the outer garments. They needed additional suspicion to justify the more invasive search. And then there were a bunch of qualifications. Maybe if they were looking for dangerous drugs, you might be more likely to have a strip search. But how important this decision will be, both in putting school officials on notice that there are limits to the kind of searches that they can do. And when you talk to students about this, by the way, in the classroom, it really gets them fired up because many of them have experienced these searches. And lots of Americans, most Americans, believe you shouldn't be subject to a strip search without some high degree of suspicion.
I want to understand this 8-1 decision, Joan Biskupic, with Clarence Thomas being the lone dissenter.
Yes, Clarence Thomas certainly distinguished himself from the majority here by saying that school officials definitely had this right and that the court shouldn't second guess the people who are on the scene. His viewpoint was essentially one of deference to the officials, which, frankly, in the past, this court has been very willing to give. In fact, there had been a trend at the Supreme Court of letting school administrators go as far as they wanted in the so-called war on drugs. This went too far. The rule that comes out of it is, by the way, the prescription drugs at issue here was
ibuprofen.
Exactly. And the majority, one of the very last opinions that David Souter wrote, said for that kind of a drug, you didn't need to take that step. You have to. School officials have to have two things. One, the dangerousness that Jeffrey referred to, but that also they have to believe that the student would be hiding the contraband in his or her underwear. I mean, you can't just think they've got it somewhere. They've got it in the backpack. They've got it in the locker. So it's going to involve small items. It's not going to involve, you know, big weapons, because it would have to be something that would be hidden that way. And some states already outlaw strip searches, but schools had been going to, you know, more and more extreme measures because they feel that the scourge of drugs is so serious on campuses.
So, David Savage, going forward, do you think school officials will thereby, because of this decision, somehow be extremely inhibited from going after students who may, in fact, be carrying dangerous drugs?
Yes, if it means a strip search. One of the good things the Supreme Court can do sometimes is say that certain things are out of bounds. You know, the justices can't get in the business of supervising schools. The Fourth Amendment says unreasonable searches by government. They've been very reluctant to get into the details of deciding what is okay, and, you know, can you search a locker and under what circumstances. But sometimes it's very important for the Supreme Court to just say, this is out of bounds. This goes too far. And I'm pretty confident that this ruling will be read by school officials and their lawyers and a lot of people saying, you cannot strip search a young girl at school for something like this. If you've got a real serious problem with somebody with a weapon, call in the police.
Yeah.
If you've got a heroin problem at school, call in the police. But you should not have school officials and nurses strip searching students. So I think that's the way it'll be read.
What about the question of a lawsuit arising from this case, Jeffrey?
A lawsuit
on the part of the girl's parents because of the Supreme Court's decision.
So at the same time that the Supreme Court said her Fourth Amendment rights were violated by the strip search, the court also said the school officials were not liable for damages because the law, when the case was decided, was not sufficiently clear to justify liability. And in this sense, they endorsed a position taken by the Obama administration. Incidentally, and this is important, I think this is the first time in years that the Department of Justice has actually come out against the police in a search case. It was unusual that the administration said this strip search went too far, but it tried to split the difference by saying the school officials should not be liable, and that's the position that the court adopted.
All right, David.
Well, I was going to say, this is an unfortunate situation for this mother and daughter. That is, their suit was the one that got this declared unconstitutional.
Right.
But they're not going to benefit from it because the law wasn't clear when it happened to her.
Right. And Justice Ginsburg and Stevens dissented, saying it didn't take a constitutional scholar to know that this was going too far. And Justice Ginsburg wrote separately to echo some of the statements she made from the bench. She is the only woman up there, of course, to say, look at the humiliation this girl suffered. Not only did she go through this search where she had to open her underwear, she then was made to sit for 2 hours outside of the principal's office, sort of to be further humiliated. And that's, interestingly enough, you asked about Clarence Thomas's dissent. In his dissent from the majority, he said, oh, like that was so bad. So there was a real divergence of opinion on just what could be so bad for a student on campus. He certainly saw it from the point of view of administrators trying to crack down on drugs and taking steps that would ensure the safety of all, whereas Justice Ginsburg looked at it from the individual point of view of the student.
And just to support Jones' point, Judge Sotomayor has no fewer than three dissenting opinions in strip search cases where, like Justice Ginsburg, she's unusually sensitive to the effects of these searches on young women. She describes in graphic terms how they must have felt humiliated during the search itself. Judge Sotomayor rejected a majority's characterization of one strip search as a clothing exchange program in a prison. So this is ridiculous. You have a tiny towel to cower behind. This is a strip search, regardless of the euphemism. I did just try to find poll numbers on this, though, and it turns out there's not a huge gender gap when it comes to strip searches. Americans generally don't like them, understandably. But young women, again, also unsurprisingly, are especially sensitive to searches of college dorms, to pat-downs and things like that. And this might be one case, although women and men judges don't vote very differently in criminal cases. They may be more sensitive to the facts, as Justice Ginsburg and Judge Sotomayor show in these strip search cases.
And, of course, there comes that word empathy, Joan.
Well, Justice Ginsburg certainly has noticed President Obama's use of it in his talk about who he wants for the Supreme Court, and also the conservative sort of mocking of that in some way. And yesterday from the bench, when she dissented aloud, taking that unusual step to read part of her dissent from the bench in the Frank Ricci case, the firefighter case, she said as she opened, "It's understandable that the majority would have some empathy for the white firefighters in this case," which I thought was a little bit of a put down toward her, the conservatives inside and outside the building.
All right. We've got a number of cases to talk about here. The court ruled on prisoners who request DNA testing of evidence. What did they say, David Savage?
They refuse to say there's a constitutional right to get DNA evidence that's on file. This seems like, I think most people, a ridiculous or outrageous ruling. It is the case that you have a lot of rights to bring in evidence or witnesses or whatever at the time of your trial. You don't have many rights, though, once you've been convicted. And that's the problem in this area of the law. This fellow was arrested for a rape and an assault. He could have had the evidence tested more and brought into the courtroom. He chose not to do it. Then several years later, he filed a suit saying, "I want this DNA testing of this sample." I think a lot of us thought that the Supreme Court would go along with this because almost every state already has, 46 or 47 states, recognizing the fact that a lot of innocent people have been found to be in prison. DNA has freed a lot of people. Why not allow testing of those samples? But the Supreme Court is sort of stiff on these sort of things, and they basically said, we're not going to say this is a constitutional right. If the
states
want to do it, that's fine and good, but we're not going to order it.
Yeah, this was another one that split the court in its familiar pattern of 5-4, with the more conservative justices basically saying, look, they were using that figure of 46, 47 states to their advantage to say state legislatures are already trying to solve this problem. Why should we come in as appointed judges and upset whatever is going on out there in the mix? And whereas the liberal justices said, you know, come on, this is important. Why not let prisoners do something that could actually get to the truth of
exactly.
a situation? So this was one of those really deep ideological splits that we often see, especially this time of year.
Although on that 5-4 question, I'm always interested in these stats because Chief Justice Roberts told me and other journalists a couple years ago that he was going to try to get a lot of unanimity on the court, and he didn't like 5-4 decisions. So for the past couple years, many of us have been looking closely. Has he succeeded? So his first term, very successful, only 11%, 5-4. But this was a honeymoon, lots of people said. People were being nice to him the way, as Justice Stevens told me, when you bring your fiancé home to meet the in-laws at Thanksgiving, everyone's trying to be nice to the new guy. His second year, this is 2007, 33%, 5-4, as the justices are sniping at each other in the partial birth abortion case, affirmative action, no unanimity. Last term, a bipartisan love fest, 20% unanimity. The justices are together in cases like lethal injection, habeas corpus rights. It looked like Roberts had really pulled it off. This term was in between the other two, 29%, 5-4. But not all of those 5-4 were the familiar ideological divides. For example, just yesterday, the court decided this case about the ability of states to sue banks for discriminatory mortgage lending. That was a 5-4 decision, but it was written by Justice Scalia, joined by the liberals with Justice Thomas in dissent. So I think we can say at this point, Roberts has had 3 full years to pursue his vision, and he's had some success, but not total success. The strip search case, 8-1, is a huge victory, and that voting rights case, which we haven't talked about, where the court, 8-1, comes up with this creative solution that Congress would never have endorsed to avoid a constitutional challenge over the Voting Rights Act and allows a municipal utility district to opt out of having to pre-clear its changes with the federal government. This was Roberts' statesmanship in its most dramatic form. He can pull it off sometimes, but not all the time.
Well, and I think it really depends on the cases. The reason we've seen the unusual variations on 5-4 this term has had to do with some particular cases, including the one that you mentioned, the banking case yesterday. But another type of case that Justice Scalia tends to be able to pull off an unusual 5-justice majority for is the Confrontation Clause. We just had one last week that involved the practice of prosecutors introducing forensic evidence at trial or seeking to introduce test results from ballistics and blood, things like that. And Scalia pulled together a majority to say that when prosecutors seek to introduce these kinds of tests, they have to have the analyst or the person, whoever prepared these tests, to testify also,
right,
so that the defendant has the right to be confronted by the witnesses against him. This is an unusual area of criminal law where Justice Scalia votes in favor of the defendants and pulls together a liberal conservative coalition, which again kind of skews these numbers, so the court sort of ends up with the cases it has, and the unusual splits that way too.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to go back to that voting rights case you mentioned, because that is so important. David Savage, give us some of the background on that.
Well, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was one of the great laws of the 20th century that transformed the country. For 100 years after the Civil War, blacks had a right to vote everywhere in this country, but in most of the South, they did not, because county registrars kept blacks from registering to vote. The 1965 Voting Rights Act sort of put all those Southern states and their municipalities on notice that they couldn't do anything in their voting and election rules until they had pre-cleared it with Washington. Everybody agrees the law is a great success. The question is it now done its job and it's outdated? Congress 3 years ago re-extended the Voting Rights Act for another 25 years. A lot of Southerners think the law is unfair. It puts them, it's like they're still on parole. They're
under still a microscope.
Under a microscope, right. I think it's a very hard legal argument to say, why is it unconstitutional? But nonetheless, that was the issue that came up to the Supreme Court. Came up in an unusual case, a little water district from Austin, Texas. Conservative lawyer, used to work for Clarence Thomas, filed this appeal and saying, our water district shouldn't have to abide by that law, and plus, the whole law is unconstitutional. It looked for a while that the 5 conservatives were going to agree and strike down the whole law as unconstitutional. For reasons we don't know, they backed away. They ended up with a fairly narrow ruling. They said, okay, this water district can bail out, and other municipalities that have a clean record can bail out, but we're not going to strike down the Voting Rights Act.
And it was an 8-1 decision.
Once again, Clarence Thomas was the dissenter.
It's a very interesting question. Is it a good thing for the court to basically change the law on its own? Now, those of us who like the idea of unanimity and narrow opinions, as I do, applaud Roberts for an act of statesmanship. Rather than taking the hardline Thomas position, he came up with a result that Congress never anticipated. Neither the Republicans or Democrats who voted for this, George Bush, when he signed the law, wouldn't have said that this little municipality can opt out under the circumstances that the court just basically made up. But conservatives are usually fond of saying the court should interpret the law, not make it. Presumably, they'd be more on the side of Clarence Thomas, saying that it's not the business of the court to be statesmanlike, and they're less interested in unanimity than in just pushing the Constitution as hard as it can go.
I want to ask you before the break about this case involving Hillary Clinton and the film that may, in fact, get into the whole question of financing for campaigns, Joan.
Right. Well, during the presidential election primary, a group called Citizens United produced and distributed a film called Hillary the Movie. Very critical film. You know, it had many conservative commentators mocking her. I think the fondest thing that was said of her was Ann Coulter's famous line, "Well, she looks good in a pantsuit." But that just gives you the tone of this movie. And the question was, should it be treated like a piece of campaign propaganda, in effect, because prohibited from being aired, or you know, any kind of promotion about it being aired so close to the election? There's a provision in federal campaign finance law that says that any kind of election
material,
communication that mentions a candidate by name and is shown shortly before a primary, a convention, or a general election is banned. And so the test was of this specific movie. But what the justices did after they heard oral arguments is they obviously struggled with how broadly to rule and what to say about federal regulation of corporate spending in elections. And that's the biggest question. You know, Hillary the Movie has some, you know, excitement to it because of the candidate and the kind of opposition that it drew, but this will be a much larger question that will be heard in September.
In September, and I want to talk about that when we come back and take your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
An estimated 2.5 million people in the U.S. have bipolar disorder, a lifelong illness characterized by mood swings and risk of suicide. What doctors and families can do to support young adults who suffer from the disease. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Patrick in Fort Worth, Texas. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Rehm. Yes, I have a question about the New Haven Fire Department. Everyone's talked about it, but no one has mentioned what question that was mentioned or possibly could have been had a cultural bias. I'm going to have to go on a limb here, but if my fireman's coming to rescue me, I'm really wanting him to know the bona fide job requirement information to get me out of a burning building, whether it's chemical analysis or did I fill up my air tank or was the questions about Shakespearean sonnets.
I certainly understand your concern, Patrick. What about that, Joan? Well, what do we know about these questions?
That's an excellent question that the listener has, and one that many of us asked, and we're told that the tests were under seal during this litigation. We do know that a lot of groundwork had gone into the city's decision on who to hire and the formation of the questions, the issue wasn't so much were they good questions, bad questions. The issue was, were they good measures of leadership? Who could be good officer candidates? Now, the Kennedy majority said, looking back at the sort of groundwork that New Haven officials had done initially before all the controversy arose, said that the test was valid, that the city officials in their action to throw out the results were turning a blind eye to the validity of it. Justice Ginsburg in her dissent raised serious questions about whether they actually were measuring the qualifications that a firefighter would have to be promoted to either the captain or lieutenant level. So to answer your caller, it wasn't so much the whether it had to do with, you know, chemical composition or things that you would hope that or how to, you know, what kind of water pressure, things that would naturally go into a firefighter's core job. It was more the idea of, did these things measure what would be the leadership qualifications for these kinds of promotions?
All right. To Michigan City, Indiana. Good morning, Dave.
Hello. My comment is that I just wonder how the case where the girl got strip searched, how that would have changed if on the second attempt when the school went in and checked her underwear, if they would have actually found drugs. And I also wonder how many cases a day do these guys actually preside over?
Very good question. I guess if they would have found drugs, it still would not have changed the result because the court's holding was that they didn't have adequate suspicion or cause to look in her underwear after they didn't find the drugs in her backpack. That still wouldn't have helped the girl because she doesn't recover either way. But the ruling is pretty clear there. The actual numbers, around 80, but what was it this year that the court actually decided?
I think 79 written decisions.
Wow.
Yeah.
They have
fewer and fewer.
Usually hear two cases in the morning, occasionally a third case in the afternoon on the weeks that they sit.
I want to ask you all about Wyeth versus Levine. I think that's a fascinating decision having to do with government approval of a particular drug.
Wyeth is an extremely interesting case. It involves something called federal preemption, which sounds very technical, but is of huge importance. And the question is, Ms. Wyeth had very sympathetic facts. She was a guitarist.
Ms. Levine,
sorry. Thanks very much. Wyeth was the company, of course.
Right.
Ms. Levine, who I had the pleasure of meeting, described how she had an illness in her arm. She was injected with a drug against protocol. They put it directly into the muscle rather than injecting it the way that it was supposed to be injected. As a result, her arm became gangrenous and had to be amputated. Terrible, terrible story. She wasn't able to play the guitar anymore. She lost her whole livelihood as well as her arm. She sued, and she won a substantial jury verdict. The company then countersued and said that because they are regulated by a federal law that regulates medical devices in this way, the state jury verdict was preempted and she shouldn't recover. Lots of people thought that she would lose because the trend before the Supreme Court has been for liberal as well as conservative justices to find in favor of federal preemption by lopsided majorities, 7-2, 8-1. The trend was very much against her, but she won. And the court held that there was no federal preemption. She was able to keep her jury verdict. And generally, this term was less good for American business than previous terms have been. Two terms ago, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce won 13 out of the 15 cases it filed. This term, it lost many more, and lots of people who like economic populism thought
and
that was a good thing.
This was a 6-3 decision, David.
Yes, I think this is really the end of one of the Bush administration's really important domestic initiatives that a lot of people may not be familiar with. But, you know, there is this sort of right that all Americans have, if you're injured by a defective product, to sue. The Bush administration took the view, and a lot of business people took the view, that if the federal government regulates that product, then that cancels your right to sue. They had pushed that on a whole lot of fronts. The Wyeth case became the big test case because it was a case about prescription drugs. You get a prescription drug, you're injured, you get sick, your husband or wife dies. Can you sue? The law had always been that way. The Bush administration tried to go to the Supreme Court, and they joined Wyeth, and to say, if the FDA regulates the drug, your right to sue is canceled. The Supreme Court disagreed. I think it's a really important decision because it really sounds the end of that whole Bush administration initiative.
And David, what about the ruling in May that insulated the Bush administration from being sued by Muslim men who were detained after 9/11.
This, on the other hand, is a big victory for the Bush administration approach, because it basically shields the top officials of the government, the policymaking officials, from being sued by, in this case, men who say they were picked up, held for months, were beaten up, were badly treated in New York prisons in the wake of 9/11. Everybody knows sort of why the government was doing it, but they just wanted to sue and say, you had no grounds for holding me, you had no grounds for beating me. And the Supreme Court took the view that these people can't sue the top officials of the government because they can't prove that John Ashcroft, for example, said go out and pick up these men and beat them up. So it's a shield for the top officials of the government.
All right, to Ypsilanti, Michigan. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning. I'm triracial. I grew up in Monroe County, Michigan, in an all-white farm community. Grew up Catholic, attended the best of schools. I couldn't get a job out of high school. I would call. I would get a very positive response over the phone. However, when I would show up, jobs were always filled. Now, as far as the fire department testing is concerned, I don't know what specific questions the test consisted of. However, I took a skilled trades test for one of the big three in the early 90s, and they had questions specific to certain trades. And I felt that it should have been a basic IQ test, because some people would have more training. As I grew up with an electrician, some people may have grown up with welders or pipe fitters or whatnot, and they would have a leg up on other participants. So I really don't know. I can't speak on the justice's decision.
Yeah. But the question about specificity of questions on tests like this raises other questions. Jeffrey.
It really does. And you could argue this either way. In his definitive history of standardized tests, the big test, Nicholas Lemon describes how standardized tests are supposed to be an antidote to precisely what you experienced,
exactly.
Jeffrey, which is that face-to-face discrimination. If you fear an employer is instinctively prejudiced against minority applicants, better, it was felt at the turn of the century when Jews were being discriminated against, to have objective tests that employers couldn't use to favor one group over another. Specificity versus non-specificity seems not to be the issue here, because most people agree that the questions are fair. They were made in consultation with minorities. The question is, do we want to have written tests at all, or do we prefer these holistic assessment centers that both Justice Kennedy and Justice Ginsburg sort of endorsed? And the hydraulic pressure now is in favor of throwing out any tests at all, instead having holistic assessment. But that might lead, as you suggest, Jeffrey, to more discrimination rather than less, which is what makes it such an interesting and complicated
question.
Let's
take a caller in Durham, North Carolina. Hi there, Wynn.
Good morning. I just have three quick comments, kind of scattershot. The first, I was amazed at the comment that the habeas decisions had some sort of unanimity. Those were 5-4 decisions, but for Kennedy coming down on the side of habeas, President Bush could have thrown any of us in jail by designating us as an enemy combatant. Secondly, the DNA decision, in the lower court, the defendant's attorney, not the defendant, made the choice not to test the DNA. And she made that admission in oral argument before the Supreme Court. And lastly, Thomas's dissent in the strip search case, I think, really gives credence to what Anita Hill said on the Hill during his confirmation hearings.
Thanks for calling. Habeas, his or the court's decisions, 5-4.
Those decisions were not generally made this term. The case about immunity was a more technical question about whether Bush people could be sued. And here it's worth noting two of the big areas you mentioned, habeas and DNA, are cases where the Obama administration and the Bush administration are on the same side. We read in the newspapers that Obama is on the verge of endorsing an executive order that would allow at least the detention of non-citizens abroad, one of the most controversial of the Bush policies. The Obama Justice Department has defended former Bush administration officials like John Yoo and is filing briefs saying that they should not be subject to broad liability. And of course, the Obama administration, I should say in the case argued by my brother-in-law, who's the Deputy Solicitor General in the DNA case, actually endorsed the Bush administration's position and said there was no constitutional right to DNA. So these cases may or may not be right, but they're cases where Obama and Bush are on the same side.
John, I want to go back to the Hillary Clinton film, the expansion to campaign finance, and the fact that it's going to be reheard by the court September 7th.
September 9th, right.
September 9th, a month earlier than the court usually begins its full term. The questions, how often does that happen? And number two, how unusual is it that the court would rehear arguments expanded?
Right. Very, very rare. In my 20 years covering the court, I can think of fewer than five times that it's happened that they've heard it out of session this way. What they're obviously trying to do is have it heard within what is formally the current term before the next one opens, even though they recessed yesterday. It means that there's some pressure now on the Senate to finish up with the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor so that she's in place, because David Souter is already gone. He's no longer, he won't be there no matter what happens with Judge Sotomayor. The important thing here for anybody who, for everyone, but specifically people who deal in campaigns, is just what kind of federal regulation there can be of corporate spending in campaigns. And what the court did when it announced that it was going to rehear the case is that it made clear that it's going to reconsider a 1990 precedent and go right to the core of the law that a lot of us know as McCain-Feingold, the Bipartisan Reform Campaign Act of about 5 years ago, in which Congress tried to get more of a handle on regulation of wealthy interests in campaigns.
David.
I think this case is actually the flip side of what happened with the voting rights case. In the voting rights case, they had a big question, and they agreed to go narrow, decided very narrowly and dispose of it. In the Hillary Clinton case, they had an interesting campaign finance case, and they decided to go broad and decide the bigger question, which is to say, can the government continue to regulate spending by corporations? Scalia and a lot of conservatives say corporations have a free speech right, just like all the rest of us, to spend money in campaigns to tout candidates. And I think the Supreme Court is on the verge of saying that. If they do, it will be a big change in the way campaigns are funded around the country, because it will allow corporations to directly, not to give money necessarily to candidates, but to run ads for or against candidates in their campaigns.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. An emailer wants to know how it's decided who writes the opinion, and are we sure that the questions are sealed that the firefighters had?
Who writes the decision? This is the Chief Justice's greatest power, and as John Roberts told me, not only is it my greatest power, it's my only power. If the Chief Justice is in the majority, then he can either write it himself, or he can give the decision to the justice he thinks will best reflect his views. So if there's someone who's sort of on the fence and is shaky, he might assign it to that justice. And often, usually nowadays, that's Justice Kennedy. And that's why no one was surprised that this important Ricci decision was written by Justice Kennedy, because Chief Justice Roberts must have thought, I've got to make sure I keep Tony Kennedy on board. I'm going to let him write this, and whatever he says will define the law.
And what about the issue of questions sealed? They have been sealed throughout this whole argument.
I have not seen in any record a listing of all the questions.
Have you?
My colleagues haven't either.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, let me ask you about David Souter's legacy. David Savage.
It's an interesting story. You know, he came to the court, a George Bush appointee. He was known as a conservative guy from New Hampshire. He turned out to be a conservative guy from New Hampshire, but not in the Washington sense of the term. He's not an ideological conservative. I think all of you perhaps have gone to see. He's like talking to somebody from another century. You can go by to see him. He sits in an office with the lights out, sits next to the window for natural light. Everybody thinks he hates to waste money on electricity. He's a very old-fashioned guy, and probably the hardest working member of the court. Nobody puts in more time reading and preparing for cases than Souter. He decides cases very narrowly. He doesn't write big opinions. He doesn't write memorable opinions. But he's a very old-fashioned, decide each case by the facts. I think he's every time you talk to him, he's such a civil and a delightful person. I think all of us will miss him.
What other Supreme Court justice would leave the bench by quoting Robert Frost for those situations where love and need are one? I mean, it was just remarkable, so elegant, so distinctly individualistic as Souter is.
I gather there were some really human exchanges on the court yesterday.
Oh, there were, and it was very nice. Chief Justice John Roberts read a letter that all of his colleagues had signed to David Souter, referring to him eagerly returning to his home state of New Hampshire, exchanging the white marble of the Supreme Court for the white mountains. And Justice Souter is really was one of a kind. And in the last couple of weeks, he went out talking a little bit, and he mentioned that he has missed all his reading for pleasure and referred to undergoing an intellectual lobotomy each term. And now he will no longer have to do that.
Joan Biskupic of USA Today. Jeffrey Rosen. He's professor of law at George Washington University. David Savage. He's a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. Thank you all. And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.